Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. How do you balance tradition and innovation? In this episode, Lewis Center Director F. Douglas Poe Jr. speaks with Reverend Amy Butler of the Riverside Church in New York City. They discuss insights for leading a historic church.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I'm Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center, and your host for this talk. Joining me is Reverend Amy Butler, the lead pastor of the Riverside Church in the city of New York. Our focus for this podcast is leading a historic congregation. Amy, most pastors are always trying to stay on top of things, and one way to do this is by reading books or articles. What have you read recently that is influencing your thinking about leadership?
Most pastors I know are scrambling to finish their sermons on Sunday night.
That is true also.
So I have been reading for fun lately some historical fiction because I just got back from a church history tour of London. But I did also have the opportunity to read a wonderful book by Nancy Cohen from Harvard called Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. I'm a buff for history, and she sort of weaves the stories of courageous leaders through history and pulls out from their stories some really essential leadership lessons. And it's just a really powerful read. I would recommend it to anybody.
It sounds wonderful. Is there one sort of example that sticks out in your mind that you would like to share?
Well, the one that has been most impactful to me was her chapter on Abraham Lincoln. And in that chapter, she talks a lot about, the personal toll that good leaders pay for their work, and sort of extracts from his life some of the qualities of good leaders as it relates to the personal price that you pay, and also the personal gain that you experience as a leader. So I liked that one the best, but they're all good.
Well, good. Thank you for sharing that with us. As we start thinking about your work at Riverside, as you obviously know, being the lead pastor, Riverside has this rich history. Can you share in a couple minutes some of the highlights of that rich history?
Sure. There's so much around you in this building, and it's so funny, I read about it in seminary and studied the sermons of many of my predecessors, and then to be in it every day is almost surreal. This church was founded almost 90 years ago by John Rockefeller, and as the story goes, he really felt like he wanted to build a place of prayer for all people, and so he went up to St. John the Divine Cathedral, this beautiful cathedral on 110th Street, and told the bishop there that he would like to contribute the money to finish the building of the cathedral if the bishop would turn it into an ecumenical prayer space, John Rockefeller being a Baptist. And the Episcopal bishop said, no thanks. And so John went, like you do 10 blocks up the street and built his own cathedral. And so this is a beautiful, beautiful cathedral built under the very close watching eye of John Rockefeller. It's the tallest church in America. And as you might imagine, there's so much power and money infused into just sort of the history of these stones. The beautiful thing that happened to this church was that Harry Emerson Fosdick was the popular pastor, preacher in Manhattan at the time, and John Rockefeller, being a man who was accustomed to getting what he wanted, tried to entice Fosdick to come start preaching at this beautiful new cathedral. And Harry Emerson Fosdick said no several times because he didn't want to be controlled by all that money and power. And as it turns out, Fosdick and Rockefeller ended up being very good friends, and Fosdick did a lot to temper John Rockefeller's socially conservative views. And since that time, of course, this church has been a bastion of social justice. It's had many pastors who are passionate about various social justice issues. Bill Coffin, of course, was very active in the anti-nuclear movement in the church, as well as LGBTQ rights and anti-apartheid movement. And then, of course, civil rights. And when Dr. Forbes was here, he was very active in issues of racial reconciliation and so on. And so this church has now gained this reputation as a platform where we are speaking prophetically to the issues of our day. And that has been one of the most beautiful and wonderful things about being in this pulpit. It's a completely free pulpit. And my congregation expects me to be a voice that is saying things that perhaps other people cannot say, and using this platform to engage conversations that that the church has traditionally shied away from.
As you talk about that sort of engagement, and even I imagine in a congregation like Riverside that not everyone agrees on every single issue, even when it comes to social justice. So right. How do you enter into those dialogues, especially from the pulpit, in a way where you certainly have sort of a strong opinion and stance, but yet you also want to be mindful that there might be varying views in your congregation?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's a question that a lot of pastors are asking themselves these days. And if they're not, they're not paying attention. I actually think that I have a slightly different challenge because this is such a almost universally progressive congregation. There are increasingly differing political views, but for the most part, very, very a liberal congregation. And we progressive liberal Christians have a tendency to turn church into a political rally every week. And so for me, I think the task has been to pull my people back to the gospel, to taking a consistent and diligent and disciplined look at the words and teachings of Jesus, and to be sure to craft whatever it is that we are saying and proclaiming within the context of the gospel and certainly within the biblical witness. And so I'll give you an example. After the president was elected and he signed an executive order on immigration, what we did in response was our clergy came up on Sunday morning and read every passage in the Bible that addressed the issue of welcoming the stranger. That way we are solidly grounding our political stance in the witness of Scripture. And so that's been sort of how I'm walking the line these days.
That's helpful. And as a follow-up, as you, an example you just gave with immigration, what was that sort of eye-opening for the people in the congregation to hear these various texts? Because I have to imagine that many of them didn't realize there were sort of this many texts that related to welcoming the stranger. And when you engage in that sort of practice, does it really open your eyes to the Bible in a different way?
Yes, I think it does. And I think I think it's been one of my joys pastoring this congregation to see them maybe even embracing their faith in new and fresh ways, because again, those of us who are on the very progressive end of the spectrum sometimes tend to be a little embarrassed, you know, by the Bible and basically the way that American society has defined and expressed Christian faith, which this is another whole podcast, but I don't really think what's going on now is Christian faith. But I think in a way people in that situation were like, oh my goodness, the Bible is a resource that speaks to the issues of our day. And I felt sort of like a relief and a joy and a less of that sort of embarrassment. Like, I can be a person of faith and I can speak prophetically to these issues. And so that's been one wonderful thing for my congregation. The second thing has been, you know, Riverside has always been a gathering place for people of faith all over this country and around the world. And now with the advent of social media, we are experiencing opportunities that we never had before in terms of being a platform for some of these messages. So in the case of that Sunday, you know, that was viewed over 2 million times. You know, there were churches all over the world who were watching us read those passages. And so I think in a way Riverside is coming to understand our public platform in a new way and grappling with what it means to steward that platform in a faithful way.
You've triggered a couple different questions in my mind. Let me begin with the prophetic question. The word prophetic, as you know, is used by almost everyone, I feel like, in ministry. And people always have sort of different ways they're using that language or different thoughts about what it means to be prophetic. What comes to mind for you when you're using that term prophetic?
So for me, it has to come back to gospel. So I'll always pull us back to the answer to this question is, does it reflect the fundamental teachings of Jesus, which are love God and love your neighbor? And if we use that as our measuring stick, then we will be asked to go very far in creating communities that are open and accepting, maybe beyond what we're comfortable with. And so that would be the standard that I will always try to pull us back to. A sort of practical question, and maybe you were asking some of this too, is, you know, you can't do everything. So, you know, if you want to be prophetic about every single thing, you're going to be really, really busy, and you're probably not going to accomplish very much in an effective way.
That is correct.
Right. So we struggle with that and try to keep our focus pretty concentrated so that we can make sure that whatever we're speaking to, we're doing it in a way that has integrity and impact.
That makes sense. And I'm imagining that what you try to do is really think about your vision and mission for the congregation, and the way you think about being prophetic falls in line with the vision and mission.
Yes. So I am a leader who feels very passionately about strong administrative structure. And I've had to grapple personally with how do I weigh doing the internal work of institutional health with the external, you know, sort of the sexy prophetic proclamation. And I'm really of the opinion that we are most effective in our prophetic proclamation when we are healthy and actually living out the witness of beloved community inside our walls. And so for me, my primary and first focus is forming disciples and leading healthy community here in the walls of the Riverside Church. Because I feel like if we can do that, then the outward prophetic expression is going to come, and it is also going to have a depth of integrity to it that it certainly will not when we're fighting with each other and getting on the front page of the New York Daily News.
Yeah, right? That makes good sense. I'm going to shift a little bit. I want to ask you, in terms of leading a historic congregation, there are, as you know, many pastors who lead historic congregations not only here in the United States, but really all around the world. What have you learned that can help them to navigate the challenges of such, you know, leading such congregations can bring, just in terms of building, you're inheriting individuals who up to this point have heard something about you but don't completely know you. So how do you sort of navigate through all those waters and try to help move things forward in a way that is helpful and godly?
How long is this podcast?
I love that answer.
So I always start with thinking about, you know, the word and the idea of institution is actually stands in contrast to what it is we teach about this God who is ever creating new life in and among us, right? An institution is fundamentally at its core designed to keep something entombed and to keep things exactly the way they are. As we know, God doesn't work that way, and neither do human communities. And so those of us who pastor, especially institutions with long and prominent histories, have a big task on our hands to create, to teach a theological framework and to create a community that allows for the discomfort of the winds of God's Spirit. I don't think that an institution is unable to pivot with the winds of God's Spirit, but it takes a strong leader with a very clear theological framework who is willing to experience and live through discomfort and lead his people through that as well. It's what you and I know. We've always done it that way, or that wasn't, you know, people carrying around highlighted dog-eared copies of the bylaws, you know.
That's right.
These are some of the challenges that pastors like me face day in and day out. And moving institutions that get stuck where they are is excruciatingly difficult, and sophisticated leadership, because it involves politics, management, theology, all kinds of different professional skills that many of us, you know, didn't learn in seminary. So it's a particular challenge, and especially in this day and age when the church as an institution is in decline. You know, in 1950, didn't have to work very hard to get people in the doors, but now we do. And when people are experiencing a feeling of scarcity, then fear comes to the surface, and we have a harder time living into that sort of risky discipleship that God requires of us. So I think now is an especially difficult time for those of us who lead historic institutions.
As you were talking, I was really struck by, of course, being a professor at a seminary, you were talking about some of the skills needed to lead a historic congregation, and that you don't learn some of those skills in seminary. So how did you learn how to sort of navigate the political waters and how to do some of these things that you've needed to do so? So where did you build up that skill set?
Well, it's been a lot of mistakes. I've made a lot of mistakes. And, you know, learning by trial and error is a big part of my story. But I do have to say, and I'm not just saying this because you're interviewing me, but I was in the first class of Lewis Fellows. And I think at the time, they were trying to create an ecumenically diverse group. And I was a nice little Baptist who looked like she needed some help. And so I had the opportunity to be part of that cohort. And I have to tell you, it changed my life. It was for me like getting an MBA almost, being exposed to literature and people and practices that were foreign to me. And so these were put into a toolbox that I still use to this day. And in addition to those tools, I met some of the most phenomenal young leaders in that cohort, some of whom are my trusted colleagues to this day. So I have to credit Lewis Fellows for giving me a lot of the practical knowledge that I have needed up until this point. I'll also say,
I just want to point out, we did not pay you to make that wonderful advertisement.
You did not. I will also say that I always like to joke, I have a whole team that supports me, that keeps my head above water. And I am a leader who is not reticent about asking for help. And so I have a spiritual director, and I have a coach, and I have a clergy colleague group, and all of these different tools that are sources of wisdom for me when I get stuck, and also sources of accountability. And I could never do this on my own.
And as you were talking, I am sure that as you have started to settle in at Riverside, there have been some things that you have started and some new ideas that you want to see come to fruition. And once again, as you know, when you're at a historic place, it can be challenging to get buy-in to do new things. So can you share with sort of how you were able to get people to buy in to some of the things that you wanted to do or some of the things you wanted to start?
Well, still working on that to some degree, as I think we always are as pastors. One of the things that was a gift to me when I came in was that this congregation in particular had about 7.5 years of rotating leadership. So in between the 18 years that Dr. Forbes was senior minister, Dr. Braxton came but was only here for less than a year. And around him were other interims at various points. And so by the time they hired me, they were okay, we're done. We want someone who's going to stay for a while and help us figure this out. And so I rode that train for just a little while and got some things done. So that helped me. But I also know what all of us know, and that is that the only way that things change is through relationship. And so I spent a large part of my first 3 years building relationships with the congregation. And I did that by being in the pulpit as much as I could, by standing at the door in the back, by keeping 4 appointments a week on my schedule for any member of the congregation who wanted to come, by starting something called the pastor's table, where I would have breakfast twice a month with 10 different congregation members at my home. Doing things like that, that built a level of trust that allowed us to sort of hold each other's hands through some of the tough transitions. I will also say that with the help of a really wise coach, I took a very hard look at the staff structure and makeup here at the church and determined early on that some very significant changes had to be made. And I made those changes, and I am fortunate enough to work with some really tremendously gifted staff members, and that helps. That helps a lot.
Thank you. I think that was helpful, because I do think it's something that people are always, as you say, trying to figure out, how do I get folk to buy into what I'm trying to do? As you think about one of the other, I would call it challenges in leading a historic congregation is before you get there, there's already this perception of who the congregation is from those who are outside of the congregation. We've sort of been talking a lot about the inside, but as you talked about earlier, you're trying to reach people. So those who are outside see you in a particular way. And sometimes it could be good, and sometimes it may not be so good. How do you try to sort of shape a message, particularly for those who don't particularly see you in a good light, to see you differently as you're trying to work on some of the things you've talked about inside of the congregation?
That's interesting. Well, I really believe that a big important part of leadership, particularly in in the realm of transformational leadership when you're trying to transition a big institution is sort of painting a vision for who you want to be, like creating a vision for who you want to be. Some people call that like being fake, but I just think that one of the things I really believe is we have to create a perception that we could live into. So in the situation of the Riverside Church, there had been recent controversy here in New York, but overall, if a little dusty, the church's reputation was still holding fairly strong. And so I sort of felt like it was my job to come in and sort of brush it off a little bit, shine it up, and begin projecting to the world who we are trying to grow into becoming. So I've done that a lot through social media. And I started using my own social media platforms. And then we were fortunate enough to hire a minister who focuses on digital discipleship and online engagement. And so we are really projecting out to the world resources and programming that we think is reflective of maybe not who we exactly are all the time, but who we are hoping to become. And that's been probably the most powerful tool to do that. A second thing is using the media. You know, one of the things that happened to me when I came here was that everybody was interested in what it was like to be the first woman of the pastor of the Riverside Church. And I have to tell you, that was just so annoying to me. You know, like I don't know what it, you know, right. I've never been a man, so I don't know, you know. And I was kind of resentful, like, you know, like you think I got this job just because I'm a woman, you know, is that the only thing that's compelling here? But I soon realized that, you know, that curiosity was an opportunity for me to talk about what I believed about the Riverside Church, about its witness, about what it has been and what it could become. And once I realized that, I began using that as a tool. And then the third thing is, and you cannot discount this, I started just changing the way things look around the building.
Interesting.
Like, for example, yeah, like, so those of you who have been to Riverside Church know that it's this big stone cathedral, and it kind of looks sometimes like you're walking into a torture chamber, which is not, you know, the image that we would want to project to all of the people who are streaming through our building every day, coming to the nursery school, going to Columbia classes, coming here for events. And so we did things like change the light bulbs so it's brighter and begin putting pictures up around the building that reflect the life of our community and sort of paint a picture of who we want to be together. And, you know, just little things like that have been so impactful.
That's wonderful. I don't think a lot of people think about how aesthetics can really help them to alter the perception that people have when they visit the congregation. So that's really
helpful. Right, because you know as well as I do, we become blind to our surroundings. Like, you say you want to be a multiracial church. Well, what does it say when someone walks in your front door and there's like 10 pictures of the white man senior pastors who have been head of the congregation? You know, what does that say? So trying to think creatively about that.
Yeah, that makes good sense. You've mentioned social media a couple of times. Do you believe that the future will be with more and more congregations not thinking so much about individuals just necessarily connecting with the people right there in their community, but connecting with the community and thinking more globally about how to use social media to help to get the message out and resources out, because we really are sort of a more of a global world today?
Mm. So any church that is not actively using social media is leaving a major tool for ministry on the side of the road. So someone explained it to me like I can't believe that you have a minister who does digital media. Well, back in 1950, we had ministers who did evangelism, right? Absolutely. It's kind of the same thing. It's just a new way of doing it. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think we're at this very interesting moment where we're having to experiment and think about how we build community in a virtual space. So we know that the power of the church is connection, people connecting to each other around a shared mission. And that's a little different and a little harder when you're distant. But, you know, there are over 1,000 people tuning in to watch our services on Sunday morning. That's not just, you know, a few people who are feeling sick, so stayed home in their pajamas. That's like, that's a whole congregation of people all over the world. And so we don't know the answers to that, but we are experimenting with that. There are little groups in places like England and Nevada who get together to watch our services. So that's been something we've experimented with. But also, you know, we have the resources and the platform to do some very, very interesting programming here. For example, Brené Brown and DeRay McKesson in conversation here on February 1st. How can we make that kind of resource available through live stream to communities around the country? And so we had, you know, almost 30 congregations and synagogues who were together watching what was going on in the nave of the Riverside Church and having intense discussions about how it informed their life together as community. And so we're experimenting with some of those things. And I think it's kind of a whole new world ahead of us.
Yeah, I would agree. So as we get close to the end, I'm curious of how do you measure success for your work? And I'm thinking about beyond sort of the normal metrics of just numbers. Are there other ways that you think about, yes, we're on the right track, or yes, we're being successful in what we're trying to do?
Yeah, this is such a good question for this moment, because if we are using the traditional metrics to measure success, we're not going to be successful. You know, I mean, the church is changing. It's not a popular social institution anymore. And so traditional metrics are not going to serve us well if we are trying to discern whether we are accomplishing our mission. So for me, I think it starts with personal discipleship. So how many lives are being changed by the work of this church? How many people are being transformed through worship, through community programming, through online engagement? I mean, how many times do we touch another person's life, either virtually or in person? And so that's one way I try to look at it. Another way is measuring the tangible expression of our ministry and mission. So not so much what are people giving to the church or how many people are coming to worship, but how many times have we engaged with our community this week? How many people have been through our food pantry? How many? So things like that. Those are some of the ways that I'm experimenting with measuring success. And some of them are just intangible measurements too. Like, is there a spirit of love and kindness in this place? Do we treat each other with respect? Yeah, you know, things good. Like that.
Yeah, that's very good. So my last question for you is, who has been a mentor or influenced you on your journey as a pastor?
Wow. There have been many people, kind people, who have taken me under their wing. And
well, if you could think of one who sticks out for you, just for today, you could change tomorrow.
So I'll tell you the story of somebody that a lot of people wouldn't know. He was the pastor of First Baptist Church in Washington, D.C. when I came to be the senior minister at Calvary, which was across town in Washington. And Jim Somerville is about 20 years ahead of me in his career. And he is, I call him Pastor Good Hair, because he's just like so your stereotypical Baptist minister. You know, he has this wonderful hair and white teeth, and he's a great preacher. And, you know, I was instantly suspicious of him. And, you know, he took me out to lunch when I first came to town, and I know he could see, like, here's this poor young girl, and she is, like, floundering. I was 3 weeks in, and I was like, you mean I got to preach every single week? Like, I already said everything I know. And so Jim said, you know, I really need a conversation partner. Would you meet with me on Monday mornings at Starbucks to talk about sermons? And that man met with me for probably 5 years every single Monday. And now that I look back on it, I think, you know, he did not need me. You know, he taught me how to preach, and he taught me how to be a pastor, and he helped me learn that collegial community was essential to my life as a minister. And I will always have Jim to thank for that.
Wow, that's wonderful. That's a great story. Well, Amy, thank you so much for your time and sharing your thoughts with us. It's been fantastic.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for the honor.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by Discovering God's Future for Your Church. This turnkey video toolkit helps your congregation discern and implement God's vision for your church's next faithful steps. Discovering God's Future for Your Church is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/shop. On our next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, Lewis Center Associate Director Ann Michael speaks with Reverend Adam Hamilton of the Church of the Resurrection in Leawood, Kansas. They discuss his newest book, Unafraid, and how faith speaks to fear in the life of both individuals and institutions. Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes, the Google Play Store, and Stitcher. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.